Why would the goal not be to collect Bitcoin? I mean, it's the best form of money. It's not corruptible. It's also programmable. But once a human's not in the loop, you have basically what you do, like, you know, with an agent where you go say, hey, I want to buy a pair of shoes. They look like this and this and this. You have access to my credit card or my Bitcoin or my, you know, Venmo account or whatever. For the next 2 hours, you can spend $200, go, you know, and then presumably once it starts working well enough, you know, it'll come back, say, you know, how do you like these sneakers? And you say yes or no, and you figure it out. And then you press go and it goes and buys them and then gets them delivered to your door.
AI models are advancing at a blinding pace. And it was only a few years ago where we didn't even have access to the tools today that seem indispensable. And this week we are talking about the synergy between AI and Bitcoin and the emerging agentic workforce with our very own John Ely, Chief Innovation Officer at Block Rewards. John always blows my mind with his insights into technology. His second time on the show, a conversation I enjoyed a lot. Stick around. All right, welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. This week, we are joined by a member of the Block Rewards team, a return guest, our Chief Innovation Officer, John Ely. John, welcome back to the show. It's been too long.
It has been. Scott, thanks for having me on. Always love all the guests you got. So proud to be on here a second time. And yeah, things are good.
When you first came on the show, we were talking about information theory and sort of the evolution of like a Bitcoin technology. You're you know, among many other things, you're a technologist, and today's conversation is going to be more centered around AI and some of the work you're doing for us and with respect to AI. But yeah, why don't we just start at 50,000 feet and with a picture of how you see what's going on today, and we'll go from there.
Thanks. Sounds good. Yeah, I mean, last week I thought it was pretty interesting when Tesla announced that they had just produced the first car that drove off the production line, drove itself to its first customer, you know, fully autonomous on highways, driving for 20 minutes, parking itself in its in their driveway, and then, you know, able to be used by the customer. I think that's a pretty cool landmark and a sign of the times. I mean, if we can use AI to navigate the real world and have full self-driving cars, and, you know, it seems like Elon Musk's vision of the robo-taxi is coming about as well, where, you know, not only does it drive to your driveway, but you can press a button and it basically becomes a fleet of a robo-taxi, like a sort of AI Uber. I think the future is looking pretty wild. The other thing, you know, I follow a lot of the tech trends. And for instance, Y Combinator, kind of the preeminent tech accelerator out of San Francisco, you know, they talk about, I think it's, you know, something over 80 or 90% of their cohort are all building in AI, building AI agents. I read a stat the other day that 90% of high growth startups are using AI agents, deploying AI agents. And I think it was Google that said that 30% of their code is now written by AI. So it's not even just edited by AI, but it's being created by AI. So the technologies are limitless.
And I think like probably most people now are using AI in some form and probably generally related to language models, ChatGPT and those kinds of services, or, you know, text to speech, you know, like the images. To keep it really basic, like, you know, this term agent, what does that refer to?
Right. Yeah. So agent, I guess it's something that people sort of arguing about the definition of it, but it essentially is, you know, you could call the Tesla car an agent. It's basically an AI technology that has a single purpose. And so, you know, you could imagine an agent that goes out and scours the web and finds leads for your company, or you could have an agent that helps you code your computer. So, you know, you'd connect it to certain data repositories and tell it that you needed to solve these issues, and an agent would go off and do that. So it's kind of an LLM actually. So it's like a ChatGPT LLM, but it's wrapped in sort of a logic, has a purpose. has access to tools. So I use ChatGPT all the time. Not always a fan of some of the ways they deal with things, but the ChatGPT is excellent. You can now in ChatGPT you can use they have these things called connectors, and you can connect to all these different things through a technology called MCP, where whether you connect to your Gmail or at Block Rewards we use Confluence and Jira and different systems. We can connect to those things. You can connect to your HubSpot. And essentially, you can have the sort of power of the LLM with the data repository of the other thing. So in this case, maybe it's your email. And so you can actually go and query your email or read your email or get summaries of your email through ChatGPT by connecting these things. So it's these things are I think they might have included that in the ChatGPT only in the last month or so. These things just keep advancing so quickly.
You know, I think like cars, whatever the service or agent is doing, it's like universally acknowledged that it's moving so fast that it's hard for anybody to keep up with the pace of improvement. And like, unless you're using everything all the time, which almost no one is, if we just sort of have this general sense like, holy cow, 2 years ago, this thing didn't even exist, 10 months ago, AI, if it was, couldn't do fingers on hands and it was like generating an image. And now you can make like a Hollywood production movie on your, on your own. And they're like, where is this going?
Yeah, no, it's true. It is almost a full-time job keeping up with the AI that's coming out. Well, I mean, you and I both, big fans of Jeff Booth. It's that folds, 50 folds until you hit the moon. Technology is exponentially increasing. We're definitely on that curve. AI just makes it obvious that we're on that curve. And so, I think familiarity with at least some of the major models is almost necessary in jobs today. I don't know a single job where AI couldn't help you be better. And so, whether it's OpenAI or Anthropic or Google, these are things that I think everybody will need to know. And it's becoming clear that that's just sort of, it's going to embed itself. I mean, it's also interesting, it still has problems. Like you and I are both left-handed. AI won't draw me left-handed. Like I can ask it, I can say, draw a picture of me. And I'm writing with my left hand, and it actually can't do it, or it takes some convincing to do. And so essentially, it's been building off of the knowledge it was given by the internet, by scraping the internet. And when you ask it to show an old school watch, it'll almost always do it at 10 minutes to 10 minutes after two, because of the that's just what every watch ad ever shows, is because it's a nice looking display. The two lines look good on a watch that way. But what's interesting is it learns by taking in data all over the place and sort of sucking it in, and so it has these biases. But then what it eventually does is it becomes smart enough to become more general purpose as opposed to get caught in the details. And so these are sort of the waves that's happening. And so for instance, Andre Karpathy, who used to be the head of AI at Tesla, he's off doing something else. He's one of these guys that he's a great follow on Twitter, and he's always talking about sort of the future of where these things are going. And his last one was something about how the next sort of $1 million or billion or $1 trillion idea, presumably, is just this very small, very compact, general purpose based on large language model intelligence that can go onto any device and just essentially it doesn't know the history of the world. It doesn't need to know. It's got access to tools, so it can always look up what it needs to know. So it knows, vaguely who William the Conqueror is, but it doesn't know any of its history. These things actually become smaller and smaller as they resolve information. And so you know, with that, essentially AI is going to be embedded in everything, and everything's going to have a certain, you know, ability to reason and logic, just like you see these chat GPT now doing, adding that sort of level of reasoning to AI. But yeah, the, you know, back, I loved it when, you know, Saylor got up on stage and started talking about how he used deep research to basically create those MicroStrategy, you know, other products like Strike and Strife and all that. You know, I had kind of become obsessed with deep research, but I didn't know how, you know, if other people were using something better or, you know, was, but hearing what he did with it made me realize how, you know, that we were both on the same track. And essentially what he did with that, and, you know, I think today what Strike and Strife, they're ripping, you know, they're ripping higher. I think they're bound to go even higher. But Saylor essentially used deep research, which is, for those who haven't used it, essentially an agent. You'd call it an agent that is a research agent. It has connections into the internet, and it does a deep research into a variety of sources based on the prompt you give it. And then it comes back with a very, very well-written report. And it can, you know, it can be pointed out to, you know, pull together information, or it can answer questions. You can ask it to figure out strategies, et cetera. And what Saylor did was he, you know, I'm no financial engineer like he is, but he essentially took his engineering knowledge and his knowledge of financial products and said to ChatGPT deep research, you know, I want to create these perpetual bonds that are converted in, you know, backed by Bitcoin, da da da, all these different things that he wanted to do. Cause he, in Saylor's case, he knows what people want to buy. He knows they need fixed income products of different sorts because the bond market is dead. And a traditional bond market is doing very poorly. And so he's going and creating, you know, like these convertible perpetual bonds. And the way he did it was by asking deep research and probing deep research. Yeah, essentially, you know, how would I form this company? What would this product look like? How can I compete against these other products? And for all intents and purposes, he's come up with a completely new financial product by doing so. I've always stuck with technology because it's the thing that always gives me the aha moment, you know, like it's the, you know, it was the internet before, you know, in the 90s, I kind of realized, holy shit, all computers are going to be connected to each other and we're going to be building applications in the internet. That was pretty wild for me to kind of understand, because I had spent, I know you also grew up playing video games, right? And, you know, I grew up in like the late 70s playing Atari 2600, Space Invaders and Asteroids. And, you know, those things were like super rudimentary, but super fun and very, very new at the time. Of course, an Atari 2600 was never connected to the internet, right? Like it was just this little machine that you play with on your TV. And then, you know, I actually, after that, I moved to an Apple IIc. So it was before an Apple IIc. So it was before, the Macintosh, and it was the Apple II computer, and the C stood for color. And it had a color monitor. This was like the new thing, right? And it had 16 colors. That's as many colors as it possibly have. But the thing is, this thing didn't even have a hard drive. It was just a computer that ran off of floppy disks and could play games. And, you know, it had to save all of its information onto floppy disks. And then, you know, what was amazing is if you got far enough along in a game, you'd have to switch floppy disks because the game was on a different, you know, floppy disk. So so the thing is that after sort of being so focused on these computers and these sort of digital machines that were not connected to the internet. And you know, I only was able to play all these games because my brother was at university and he copied them off of people and gave me copies of them. You know, like that was the only way to get these games. You had no other way. Or you could go to a software store, but you'd pay $100 for, you know, for one title. So, but until the internet, you were sort of an island. And then And then that was the big aha moment. But you know, that's why I study AI now, because it's just, you know, every week there's another incredible thing going on.
Yeah, I remember my brother and I bringing home our Sega Genesis, and we'd had a Nintendo, and that was the jump from 8-bit graphics to 16. And we were like, we couldn't imagine how graphics could ever get better than 16-bit.
Yes. Yes, slow resolution. Yeah, I mean, we were just happy that the motion could work. I remember the Atari 26 controller, it could just go up, down, left, and right. Like that's all. And then the button, you know, so there were maybe four commands, but yeah. So then here today, you know, like, so I start playing with these coding tools, right? So, you know, there's this, everyone's talking about vibe coding. So, you know, coding with AI. So I don't, you know, I did a bit of coding in my career, but I never stuck to it. And I knew that other people would be better at it. So I was better to kind of employ people who did it as opposed to kind of doing it myself. But, you know, I play with whether it's Claude Code or earlier Claude, or presumably with ChatGPT Operator or Codex, you could probably do the same thing. But basically you can, in one single text prompt, you can ask it to create a clone of Space Invaders, you know, like, and it'll go off. This is sort of the agentic part of it. It goes off with a single task. And then what they found is that if it needs to do a deeper task, it then actually outputs first a kind of plan. Okay, so it asks itself, okay, how am I going to do this? Break down all the steps. Give me a plan, because it outputs it and then uses that as a step-by-step guide, and then zooms in on each step. So this is how they become more than just one-shot LLMs. They become a sort of series or algorithm in itself. And then once you add the ability for it to check its own work. So for instance, Claude Code will go off and create something and then take a screenshot of it, look at the screenshot and says, does this look like what it should look like? So these agents essentially have the ability to plan and reason and then evaluate their own work. And so, I mean, once that kind of stuff, I mean, these Y Combinator companies, they're all going to be launching in the next 6 to 12 months, and they will all do this kind of thing. You know, we see some of them now, but I think it's going to be an entire wave of products. And so, but even today, like, you know, Block Rewards, we're not, you know, you couldn't say we're an AI company. There's, you know, our app is not an AI app, but we use AI to code some of our software. We use it to help with customer support. You can use it in branding. You can use it in basically any area of research. You can use deep research to learn the regulations, the systems of regulations. And so, you know, it's just like every company, I started realizing every company was going to be an internet company. And every company also is essentially becoming an AI company. And, you know, how long will it be before, you know, our dev team is literally deploying different coding agents in our tech stack? Like we're using it here and there, but, you know, essentially, you know, you'll have these well-trained UX UI engineers, front-end developers, back-end developers. You know, once these systems are able to kind of have these agents working on their own, checking in and out code, so there's no interference, you know, though the software we're building will be so much different. And you know, we're also, you know, we have AI in the roadmap for our various products and how they can evolve. And, you know, any company that's using software these days, it's just a regular part. So yeah, fascinating stuff. Just back to the Apple IIc and the Atari 2600, you and I both went all in, I think, 2020 or 2019 on Bitcoin. And, you know, I basically knew I wanted to sell my property and put it into Bitcoin. And so during that, because it was, you know, it was, you could see that the bull run was coming back. I needed to get more committed to Bitcoin. And in so doing, I cleared out a bunch of my basement and had a box that was my Atari 2600 and a box that was my Apple IIc. And I sold them because I'm like, these are cool, but I kept them because they were accruing value, but I knew it was better to put them in Bitcoin at that point. And so that was fun. You know, the other thing, I mean, you're a chess player, right?
Yeah.
Chess was the first problem that, you know, they tried to solve in AI. And so, you know, AI is not new. I think it was in the 50s. Claude Shannon was first building a chess machine, and it was only powerful enough to do the last five steps of chess. But then it got, you know, better and better and better. And I think it was 90s when, you know, they had built a chess machine that could beat the best human, you know, Garry Kasparov. It beat him. I can't remember the year properly, but, and then also, did you see that Netflix series with, on Go, the AlphaGo?
Yeah. I was going to bring this up. You know, I think the Go documentary really was the first time I started thinking a lot about AI, because there are just so many, I mean, there's a lot of different potential moves and permutations in a chess game, but, Go is like infinitely more complex, and after Kasparov was defeated, you know what, you know, where it went was like, well, we'll never be able to have an AI that can beat the world's best Go players. Go is this Asian board game that has like, it looks like a checkerboard, but it's four times as big. And yeah, for anyone who's listening, that is a really incredible show. They, I think in 2016 or 2017, Deep Learning created a program that was able to actually think of moves that were so abstract that the human spectators couldn't even believe what they were seeing.
Yeah. Yeah. There was that one move that was, I think sometimes they call it the God move or the divine move or something. And it was at that time, the AlphaGo had an advantage, but the human seemed to sort of start to confuse it in a sense, like it had its heels. And, you know, the Go board sort of generally speaking, you know, goes from the center and goes out, and it had its heels. And instead of coming back with a traditional move, it actually put a piece, you know, well outside of in the periphery that typically would have very little effect, but also, you know, humans aren't able to go and check out all of the possibilities. Well, you just don't have that kind of power. So Google DeepMind AlphaGo played this piece, and everyone thought it had gone crazy. Like, oh, this is never going to work. What's it doing? It's kind of like short circuiting. And then soon it came, you know, became obvious that Lee Sedol had no idea how to play against this strategy, that Google had in fact won the game based on that. I saw a chart. I'd like to bring it up. I don't have it though. Of some of the dimensions, again, back to the Saylor strike versus strife and all these different financial products. It's almost like the God move thing, because he understands the board of, call it fixed income, right? And he knows that he's got the best engine behind him in Bitcoin. And he has full conviction in Bitcoin that it's going to do these things. And so with that, you know, if you look at certain products that he is offering, you know, if you compare them against traditional products that the other competitors are competing against based on fiat dollars, they're all in a scatter plot. They're all off to the left and down to the right. And he's gone and created one of these, like literally like a God move. He's gone and created these products that no one would ever think of, you know, and, you know, it takes deep intelligence to do that. So it's pretty fascinating.
So, you know, we were talking about automatic self-driving cars and the robotaxi and solo single purpose agents in the workplace. And it's going somewhere else next, right? Where it's more, you know, autonomous. And this term agent kind of refers to the concept of agency, right? Like that these things will be executing tasks on their own based on reasoning and like Yeah. So where is that going? Like what your vision on the future of kind of the agentic workforce?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think you see a few different models in AI coming about. So there's the typical first model is still the subscription model, like the SaaS model. So you sign up for ChatGPT, you get access to this thing, and you pay a certain amount of, you know, per month. But in a lot of cases, like in coding, you're using up tokens. And, you know, if you send off these coding agents, it's not just one prompt. You go and actually create, you send off a prompt or you send it off in a task and it goes and uses, you know, five or six different threads all going down to solve these problems using a ton of tokens. And so there's a sense, I think, that these agents might start getting paid based on, you know, kind of a value for value sort of model, like a pay per use sort of model. But then, you know, it's also interesting because AI usually sort of takes the form of whatever it's going into, I think. And so if we start using agents in a business, you'll basically be, I think agents will, you know, the first thing you need to do to an agent when you deploy it in a company, you need to give it the context of the company. You need to teach it about block rewards, what it does, what its brand is, what its colors, what its, you know, these are the people in it. It needs to be onboarded. An agent needs to learn the context for which it needs to do the work. You also need to connect it to, you know, our GitHub repository. So it has access to our code base. And then you'd go and tell it what part of the code base you want it to do. In this case, if you're sort of building a developer. But you know, also you could have an agent that goes off and finds potential prospects for your company. And so it needs to understand other parts about it. What's your LinkedIn account? Where are your contacts? What's your CRM? And then it can, you know, if it's given access to write emails, it can start to contact people and, you know, eventually produce very fine, qualified potential prospects, which, you know, I think is a win for everybody because it finds people that are truly interested in the business. And so it's not a spam sort of situation. It's a targeted, you know, smart agent that goes out and finds interested parties. But so my point, I guess, is that are those agents, sorry for the Freudian slip, those agents, not people, but are those agents paid just like a person is? You know, is that their value that you can, and, you know, they don't work 9 to 5, they can work 24/7, but is it sort of an ongoing salary? And so, our focus is Bitcoin compensation products, and you know, we onboard employees. Will we be onboarding agents just in the same way?
Hey everyone, quick question. Have you ever thought about starting a video podcast like this one? I want to introduce you to the team behind my show, Podigy. This podcast has been one of the best marketing tools for our business. And thanks to Podigy, all I have to do is hit record. They handle everything else, editing, writing, publishing, and making sure that it's perfectly optimized for every platform. They only work with disruptors, mavericks, and changemakers, people making a real difference, spreading big ideas. Typically, Podigy is fully booked, but right now they have a few spots open for new clients. Listeners of this show get 10% off launching their own podcast or optimizing their current one. Click the link in the bio for a free one-on-one podcast planning session with Podigy. If you are thinking about starting a podcast or you have one and you want to take it to the next level, I can't recommend Podigy enough. Check them out. So the question I always get when I start to talk about these and ideas is, why would an agent want to be paid and what would they do with the money?
So money is a store of value. You know, it needs resources. So if an agent needed to, I mean, we sustain the agents now. And I think that's good. I mean, we could get into, you know, I'm generally speaking a techno optimist, but I also have some, you know, some concerns about where this is going. And so you need the right guardrails. But, you know, an agent only runs because it has access to electricity. Electricity costs money. It needs money to run. And we just are the people that give it, you know, that. But the two main sort of genres, if you will, of AI that have really exploded are that, you know, this LLM stuff is all generative AI, generating things based on text prompts. But then there's reinforced learning. And in the game of chess and the game of Go, and to learn that stuff, you need to give it a goal. It needs to optimize towards a goal. And why would the goal not be to collect Bitcoin? I mean, it's the best form of money. It'll be, it's not corruptible. It's also programmable. And so I think AIs will eventually want to earn Bitcoin because I think it's better that we have humans in the loop. But once a human's not in the loop, you have basically what you do, like, you know, with whether we've talked about to other companies who are really doing interesting things with payments, with digital currencies. And, what they're talking about is essentially an agent where you go say, hey, I want to buy a pair of shoes. They look like this and this and this. You have access to my credit card or my Bitcoin or my, Venmo account or whatever. For the next 2 hours, you can spend $200. Go, and then presumably once it starts working well enough, connected to Amazon, et cetera, it'll come back, say, how do you like these sneakers? And you say yes or no, and you figure it out. And then you press go and it goes and buys them and then gets them delivered to your door. So I think that eventually payments is always the hardest part to add to something. But payments are necessary in order for an agent to do things, And so if we're talking about coding as well, if you build an AI agent that is a developer, it may need to access things that it require money. It might need a tool that costs money. It might need to get access to data that costs money. So in order for these things to become more autonomous, they need access to some kind of money. I think eventually it'll be Bitcoin. I think there'll be lots of things that are earning stable coins and US dollars and Stripe. Stripe is getting involved. Stripe is spending a ton of money trying to win that payments layer. Coinbase also, I'm a big fan of the L402 Lightning Labs protocol. But Coinbase came out with C402, which is basically like a stablecoin version, which enables payments, low-level payments with US dollars, US dollar stablecoins. So the payments game, we can see the big players are starting to really get into it. And now with, sort of the major changes in legislation in the US, and banks being able to custody Bitcoin and banks being able to deal in Bitcoin and stable coins, that's just going to become more and more entrenched as we go.
You mentioned Jeff Booth and this thesis around the deflationary nature of technology. And I think this is one of the weirder, more abstract, and probably the most compelling argument for all of this is this sort of potential synergy for Bitcoin, the monetary system, to sort of be the thing that offsets or captures the productivity gains that result from the exponential effectiveness and capacity of AI. And maybe we could just talk about that for a little bit. And because I think that this is one of those things that if you're not really deep in one or both subjects, it's a lot to wrap your head around.
Yeah, for sure. Jeff sees the future. It's Jeff lives in the future. Every word you hear, it's like, oh shit, this guy's got it figured out. And so I think in some way or another, a lot of the productivity gains will be accrued through AI into some form of money. And, I think it's Bitcoin eventually. And through a sort of payment system with Bitcoin in there and potentially stablecoins or stablecoins for now. But like, what happens when, even the Magnificent Seven, they're all essentially AI companies, and they are Meta, Apple, Microsoft, Amazon, Nvidia, Tesla, right? And these are the ones that are actually getting almost all of the productivity gains of today. So the Magnificent Seven, you know, you look at them versus the rest of the S&P 500, and they are the ones that are going up. Everything else is sort of, you know, flat. And so these sort of tech monopolies are capitalizing on AI. And I think that that's how they continue to dominate. And so that's why they're now also trying to put these major investments into it. So whether it's that future or a more decentralized future, which I would like to believe it occurs, the productivity gains are going to go to those with that technology, I think.
Yeah. And so it's like we've arrived at this point where the devaluation of money is accelerating because of the compounding nature of servicing costs of government debt and the sort of endless need to continually print more money faster and faster. And like, this is happening concurrent to what we should start to see, where it becomes undeniable that things are becoming cheaper as a result of, you know, presumably you could have, if you can have one AI bot doing your sales, you could have 100,000 doing that work, and they're all doing it 24/7. And, you know, I think of things like legal or accounting, and these are tasks that are were high skilled work done by highly educated people that that today ChatGPT can do, you know, in seconds. You know, this is true of like most white. The original feeling in general was that AI would first come for blue collar work, and it seems like the opposite's true. Like it's the white collar stuff that is really vulnerable. And so as that work becomes, you know, it's like AI is like democratizing education and skill. It's making these things available to everyone. And so you have these two things happening at the same time. And then at the other, literally, you know, headed in the opposite direction. We have this hardening form of finite money that may be the only way to actually measure sort of the exponential growth in compute.
I think essentially the fiat system is, the trillions and trillions of dollars that are now going into AI compute are a sign, and you know, the fact that they're such large numbers is almost indicative of the fact that we're at the becoming close to the end of the fiat regime, and essentially whether it be a country selling their fiat money for Bitcoin, or companies putting their corporate balance sheet in Bitcoin, they're, you know, to me and to us, the trend is that people will start to learn that you need to put it in a system whose denominator is not a dollar or not a fiat currency, and that will be Bitcoin. And yeah, I mean, it's almost like Moore's law, where the amount of compute doubled every 18 months or whatever it is, and the amount of the amount of AI that the capabilities of AI doubling all the time. We're on these curves, and eventually the best money wins. I think the best money wins, and that money is Bitcoin.
Maybe as we wrap it up, John, you're always like reluctant to forecast things, you know, further out than 2027. But what's a bold prediction for something we can expect to see play out maybe in the next year and a half?
A bold prediction. Interesting. You know, this is a little bit different than maybe you'd think the answer would be, but I've been amazed at how creative AI can be, you know, and how, and these tools, right? And, you know, whether it's taking over Hollywood, or, you know, cause it's doing these feature length films that are very convincing, or writing incredible poetry, or writing, you know, all these weird experiments with agents that can do all these different things, and image generation. And, you know, we still haven't seen a great work of art done by AI. I don't think. Maybe there's certainly examples, and people are building interesting things, but you know, eventually we'll see a piece of art or a film or a book or something that's purely AI that will stand the test of time in the pantheon of great works, right? And, you know, is that 2027? Is that 2028? You know, I can imagine. Like, to me, you know, I think it was in the end of the 1700s, there was someone named Thomas Young, and there was a book written that he was the last man who knew everything, because human knowledge was kind of exploding after that, the Industrial Revolution. But before that, a very, very smart person could kind of know everything about sort of human progress. That's probably a little bit Eurocentric, presumably. So it, you know, you could question it, but that concept is true in some way, or it's valid in some way. But you know, these LLMs, they kind of know everything again in a way, you know, especially with tool use and the ability to research and all that. So something that now knows everything today, it should be able to create a piece of art, a work of literature that no one else could possibly imagine. So I think that would be cool. That would be my bold prediction in the next 5 years.
Yeah, that's really cool. I didn't know how you're going to answer that. And, you know, makes me think of your own forays into co-authoring a mystery novel with AI. And maybe it'll be you.
Yeah, maybe. I'll have to work on it. Yeah, it's not that far. I think people will do it. Yeah.
John, it's always a pleasure. And I know we'll do this again. So thanks for coming back. And if you're listening and you made it all the way to the end of the episode, I want to thank you as well for tuning in, and hope to see you again next week.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits. Supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and BMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.